Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to John Bateman. Thank you. You may begin.
Thanks, Anthony. Good morning, and thanks, everyone, for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after the call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email, and I will spell it. The address is nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will be following can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory. If you don't have that link, I will spell it out for you now. It's https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/BRIEFINGS. With that, I'll introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Karen Gleason, a climatologist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the October U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is Dan McAvoy, a climatologist with the Western Regional Climate Center, who will review the Western U.S. drought and wildfires from 2020. And our third presenter is Dan Collins, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the temperature, precipitation, and drought outlook for the months of December, January, and February. With that, we'll go to our first speaker, who is Karen from NOAA.
Thank you, John, and welcome to today's call. I will begin by summarizing the conditions for the globe during the month of October on slide number two. The October 2020 global land and ocean surface temperature was the fourth highest for October since global records began in 1880, with a departure from average of 0.85 degrees Celsius or 1.53 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. Only Octobers of 2015, 2019, and 2018 were warmer than this. The global land-only surface temperature for October was fifth highest on record at 1.23 degrees Celsius or 2.21 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Meanwhile, the global ocean-only surface temperature departure of 0.70 degrees Celsius or 1.26 degrees Fahrenheit tied with 2017 as the fifth highest for October since global records began in 1880. Looking at the map on the upper left portion of slide number two, we see that warmer than average temperatures were observed across a large portion of the world, with record warm October temperatures across parts of the eastern and western North Pacific Ocean, southern North America, South America, Eastern Europe, the northern Middle East, eastern Mediterranean Sea, southern Asia, and in small areas across the Indian and Atlantic Oceans. Overall, about 6.8% of the world's land and ocean surfaces had a record warm October temperature, and this value ties with 2016 as the second highest October percentage of record warm across the globe since records began in 1951. October of 2015, we saw almost 20% of the globe covered by record warm temperatures. cooler than average October temperatures were observed across much of Canada, the central contiguous U.S., and across parts of southern and central Asia. The central and eastern tropical Pacific Ocean, the eastern South Pacific Ocean, and the southwestern Indian Ocean. However, no land or ocean areas had record cold October temperatures. Looking at NCI's regional analysis, which you can't see here, but just an idea of looking at specific regions and continents, Europe had its warmest October on record, and South America ranked second warmest. Now, for the year-to-date period, January to October, on the right side of this slide, the global land-only temperature departure of 1.60 degrees Celsius or 2.88 degrees Fahrenheit tied with 2016 as the highest temperature for January to October on record. The global ocean-only surface temperature was the second highest on record behind the record set back in 2016. Combined, the land and ocean temperature departure was 1.00 degrees Celsius or 1.80 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean, which ranked second warmest behind 2016. During the first 10 months of the year, they were warmer than average across much of the globe, as you can see from the map on the lower right. Record warm January to October temperature departures were widespread across northern and southeastern Asia, across parts of Central and South America and Europe. The Indian Ocean and parts of the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans were also record warm during this 10-month period. And regionally, we saw that Europe and Asia had their warmest January to October period on record. And Europe, in fact, Europe's five warmest January to October periods on record have occurred since 2014. South and the Caribbean region had their second warmest 10-month period, while Africa, Oceania had their fifth and sixth highest such periods on record, respectively. Moving along to slide number three, we will take a look at how the global temperature is faring through the first 10 months of the 12-month year. Sometimes we like to say the first 10 laps of a 12-lap race. We see that January 2020 is currently second warmest behind the record warm 2016, and this value is actually only 0.03 degrees Celsius or 0.05 degrees Fahrenheit shy of tying the record set in January to October of 2016. According to our NCEI global annual temperature rankings outlook, we see that there's a 29.2% chance of 2020 being a warmest year, and it's virtually certain that 2020 will be a top five warmest year on record, and the year 2020 is very likely to rank among the top three warmest years on record. Turning our attention to slide number four, and getting a little closer to home in the contiguous U.S., we saw that for the month of October, the average temperature was 54.4 degrees Fahrenheit, which was 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Overall, that ranks near average or in the middle third of the historical record. Looking at the map on the left-hand side of slide number four, we see that above-average temperatures were present across much of the West and the Southeast and East Coast. California ranked warmest for October on record. Below-average temperatures were observed across the northern Rockies and Plains, to the Great Lakes, and into parts of the southern Plains. And six states ranked among the coldest 10 on record in western Great Lakes, the northern and central parts of central Plains. Looking at precipitation for October, we saw that the total average was 2.16 inches, which is exactly the long-term average, which, as you might expect, will rank near average or in that middle third of the historical distribution. Looking at the map on the right-hand side of the slide, we see that above-average precipitation occurred across parts of the northern Rockies, in portions of the Great Lakes, in the Mississippi and Ohio valleys, the southeast, and as well as the northeast. Drier than average conditions were observed across quite a bit of the western U.S., the deep south, and as well as portions of the central and northern plains. California ranked second driest for October, and we saw that Nevada and Utah ranked sixth driest for the month of October. Turning our attention now to slide number five, we look at the year-to-date period, January to October, for the contiguous U.S., and we see that the temperature averaged 57 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 2.1 degrees above the long-term average. This ties with 2006 for the seventh warmest January to October on record. Looking at the map on the left-hand side of the slide, we see a lot of oranges and reds on on the slide. Those are the state ranks for each of the states for that 10-month period. And we see that above average temperatures occurred across a vast majority of the lower 48. We also saw that Arizona, New Mexico, and Florida ranked warmest for this 10-month period. Near average temperatures were observed across portions of the Central Plains, but no larger areas of below average conditions exist for this 10-month period. Turning our attention to precipitation, we see that the 10-month total average for the contiguous U.S. is 26.30 inches, which is 0.94 inches above the long-term mean, and this places 2020, the first 10 months of 2020, in the wettest third of the historical record. We see quite a bit of regional variation with below average precipitation across the western portion of the U.S. as well as portions of the northern and central plains and across parts of the northeast. Utah ranked driest for January to October. And then looking at the wetter side of the spectrum, we saw wetter than average precipitation occurring across parts of the northwest, the central and Gulf Coast to the Great Lakes, and across a lot of the southeast. Tennessee, in fact, ranked wettest on record for the January to October period. Moving on to slide number six, the latest U.S. drought monitor that was released this morning shows that there's a broad swath of drought in the western half of the contiguous U.S. We see overall about 47% of the contiguous U.S. is currently in drought, and compared to the beginning of October, it's up about 3 percentage points since then. We did see some improvements across portions of the Northeast, but we also saw intensification and broadening of drought across portions of the West and the Four Corners region, as well as the Northern Plains, and expansion across much of Texas. Outside of the contiguous U.S., we did see there was about 1% of Alaska in drought in the northwestern portion of the state, and that was eliminated. But we did see intensification drought and expansion across the state of Hawaii. And with that, I will turn it over to Dan McAvoy.
Well, great. All right. Thank you very much for that, Karen. And I'm going to be following up on Karen's last slide by showing drought conditions and discuss how we ended up in this drought situation, specifically for the western half of the U.S., and how those conditions set up the severe western fire season this year. So I'm going to start on slide seven with precipitation percentile maps. And for California, Oregon, and Washington, basically the West Coast states, the bulk of the annual precipitation for them falls in the October through March period. And last year was very dry for the Sierra Nevada, Northwest California, and into the Cascades. So the map on the left is showing the October through March precipitation percentiles. And so we see large areas in many locations in the bottom 10% of all years, which is that brownish color showing up that I've highlighted there on the left circle. And so the cold season dryness, this is what initially got the drought going and also set up the fire season for the West Coast states. Now, as we get into summer and early autumn, this is normally the dry period for the West Coast and especially California. But as you move into the Rocky Mountains and the Four Corners, they typically get substantial rains during this time. And this is also the monsoon season. And this year was exceptionally dry with large areas in the bottom 10% of the record and many areas in record dry, those darkest red colors, which is a big factor in the fire season for this region. And this is the second year in a row now with a failure of the monsoon or lack of monsoon for this region, which is also contributing to the drought conditions. So now on to slide eight, I'm going to show the other side of the fire danger story, which is the high temperatures and high evaporative demand. So we saw record or near record high August through October temperatures and evaporative demand across much of the West. So that's the map on the left is showing the temperature percentiles for October through August, and anything in red is record warmest there. On the right, we have the eddy map, and the eddy is the evaporative demand drought index. And so in addition to temperature, this includes humidity, wind speed, and solar radiation, and it's a more rounded measure of atmospheric drying or atmospheric thirst, as we like to call it, as compared to temperature. So the combination of this plus the precipitation deficits that I was showing really set the stage for fires that could ignite easily, grow rapidly, and burn very hot. And that's exactly what we had this year in the western U.S. But without ignition, you don't have fires. And so one of the biggest fire outbreaks this year was caused by a very rare mid-August lightning event, which I'm showing now on slide 9. And so it's very rare to see lightning in central and northern California in August. And this year, a multi-day event occurred, and this was due to remnants of a tropical storm that actually drew up enough moisture to create mostly dry thunderstorms with lots of lightning in the air. There was some light rain, but not nearly enough to overcome the amount of lightning and dryness, antecedent dryness that was already in place. And so there were 362 ignitions in that three-day period, and this included the August complex, which occurred in Northwest California. And so this is the August complex is now the California's largest fire on record. It burned over 1 million acres, and it was actually just fully 100% contained earlier this week. That news came out that they finally contained that fire. So the hot and dry conditions that I described earlier is what really contributed to the explosive growth and the spread of not only these fires in California, but the other fires throughout the western U.S. And so now on the slide 10, when we look at some of the numbers, you can see that there are actually fewer fires than average, but the acres burned was above average. So the numbers on the upper left show the total acres burned. This is over the whole U.S. for 2020. And that was above average, but then the total number of wildfires was below average. And so this indicates that the fires that did occur were very large. And so there were many large explosive fires, especially in California, Oregon, and Colorado, where they all saw their biggest fires in history. And a number of the fires that are shown in the map on the upper right are still burning, especially in California, in Colorado. So the map in the upper right is from October 19th, but a lot of those fires are still going. Even places where they've had snowfall in the mountains, these fires are still burning. And so one of the biggest impacts from the fires was massive amounts of smoke being pumped into the atmosphere, and that led to degraded air quality that actually reached the east coast of the United States at times. And so I'm located in Reno, Nevada, and we had almost two straight months of poor air quality, where we had days on end where we couldn't go outside to do any activity due to how bad the air quality was. And so I think I'll just end by saying, and this is something I've been hearing a lot this year, I'm somewhat new to the fire scene in terms of fire and climate. I've been studying it a lot more the past few years, and I've been hearing a lot this year that not all fire is bad fire. And it's really, and where you have low severity burned areas, that actually benefits the ecosystems, and we need that good fire. It's really only the high severity, extremely hot fires that just destroy the ecosystems that are the bad fire. And so we just need to keep that in mind as well. And with that, I will pass it over to Dan Collins.
Thank you. This is Dan Collins with the Climate Prediction Center, and I'm going to be beginning on slide number 11, I'm going to describe the state of the climate and our outlooks going forward for the next 3 months, December, January, February. So beginning on slide 11, I'm looking at the sea surface temperatures and the state of ENSO, or El Niño Southern Oscillation, or the El Niño or La Niña state. So in the upper left on slide 11, you'll see a plot of the anomalies or departures from normal sea surface temperatures for the tropical Pacific Ocean. You can see that there are below normal sea surface temperatures across the central and eastern Pacific, especially near the equator and south of the equator in the eastern Pacific. There are above normal sea surface temperatures across the North Pacific, and also in the Gulf of Mexico. This state of the sea surface temperatures represents La Niña conditions, with below normal sea surface temperatures, especially in the eastern central Pacific Ocean. We also have stronger than normal easterly trade winds across the Pacific, and precipitation over the central Pacific is less than normal, again, reflecting current La Nina conditions over the tropical Pacific. In the bottom left panel, you can see a plot of probabilities for La Nina in blue, and so neutral conditions in gray, and the probability of El Nino is indicated in red. You can see that La Nina is very likely to persist for the upcoming winter. The probability for December, January, and February is around 95%, and it is likely to persist into spring as well, with a probability exceeding 60%. After that, the probability of neutral ENSO conditions increases. From here, I'm going to go on to slide number 12 and begin to look at the outlooks for the next several months. So first on slide 12, you see the outlook for the month of December. On the left, you see the probabilities for the temperatures, the average temperatures for December. Shades of red and orange are increased probability of above normal temperatures, and shades of blue are increased probability of below normal temperatures, where the temperatures are divided into three categories: below normal, near normal, and above normal. So what you see is a broad area of likely above normal temperatures from central and southern California, across the southwest, across the central and southern plains, and virtually covering all of the eastern U.S. Probabilities exceed 50% over much of the southern U.S. and along the east coast. You also see likely above normal temperatures for western and northern Alaska, again, with probabilities exceeding 50% in some areas. You see a slight chance of below normal temperatures for southeast Alaska and parts of the northwest in the 48 states. This pattern is somewhat influenced by the current state of La Nina, that the climate state of La Nina. On the right, we look at the probability of total precipitation being above or below normal for the month of December. Below normal is here shown in brown and tan tones. Above normal is shown in green tones. And again, we divide the precipitation totals into three categories: near, below, and above and below. So you can see that the probability there's likely below normal precipitation across much of the southern U.S., from southern California across the southwest into parts of the Great Plains, across the southeast and Gulf Coast, and parts of the South Atlantic coast as well. Probabilities of above normal are more likely for the Pacific Northwest into the northern Rockies, and for an area stretching from the Ohio Valley to the eastern Great Lakes and parts of New England. This pattern is somewhat influenced also by the La Nina state of the climate. For Alaska, you can see that above normal precipitation is likely for western Alaska, and there's a slight increase in the chance of below normal precipitation for southeastern Alaska for the month of December. From here, I'm moving on to the next slide, which is slide number 13. And this is looking at the winter forecast. That is the 3 months of December, January, and February. On the left panel, again, we have the forecast for temperature, for the average temperatures for December, January, February period. Again, above normal is indicated by red and orange tones, and below normal is indicated by blue tones. So you see a similar pattern with some changes from the month of December. Again, above normal temperatures are likely across much of the southern U.S., from the southwest, across the plains, across the lower Mississippi Valley into the southeast, and again, above normal temperatures are likely up the east coast of the U.S. Probabilities are somewhat high for parts of the southwest and southern Texas, with probabilities above 60% that temperatures will be above normal for this season. Below normal temperatures are more likely for parts of the Pacific Northwest, extending across the Northern Rockies into the Northern Plains. Below normal temperatures are also more likely for southeastern Alaska, and above normal temperatures are most likely for western Alaska and parts of northern Alaska. This pattern, once again, is largely influenced by the ongoing La Nina conditions over the tropical Pacific, and is also influenced by long-term trends in temperature over several decades. Turning now our attention to the panel on the right, this is the December, January, February precipitation forecast. Above normal is again indicated by green shades, and below normal is indicated by brown and tan shades. Below normal precipitation is more likely across the southern U.S., and above normal is more likely across the northern U.S. Below normal probabilities of below normal exceed 50% for parts of Southern California, the Southwest, Texas, and the Gulf Coast, and probabilities exceed 60% in some areas of the Southwest and Western Texas. Above normal precipitation is likely from the Pacific Northwest across the Great Plains into the Great Lakes, as well as parts of the Central Mississippi Valley and Ohio Valley, and some parts of the Northeast. Below normal precipitation is most likely for southeastern Alaska, once again, similar to the month of December. And above normal precipitation is most likely for parts of northwestern Alaska. This pattern as well is highly influenced by the La Nina conditions in the tropical Pacific. Moving now to slide number 14, this is a look at the U.S. drought outlook. This figure shows the areas that were shown previously in the U.S. drought monitor and whether drought is expected to persist, which is shown in brown, remain but improve some, shown in gray, complete removal, shown in green, or whether drought is likely to develop, shown in yellow. This pattern is largely consistent with the monthly outlooks for December and the seasonal outlook for December, January, February that we showed previously. Drought is likely to persist across the southwest of the U.S. and through the Great Plains region. In fact, drought development is likely for parts of California and for parts of the Great Plains and Southern Plains that are not yet in drought. Drought is also likely to develop for parts of the southeast. This is somewhat consistent with the La Nina precipitation pattern, which showed that below normal precipitation is likely across much of the southern U.S. as a result of La Nina. La Nina should bring above normal precipitation to parts of the Pacific Northwest, so there, current drought conditions are likely to improve or in some cases to be removed entirely. Also, from the central Mississippi Valley up into the northeastern U.S., drought is likely to improve or be removed over the next 3 months as a result of both above normal precipitation in some areas due to La Nina conditions or because of climatologically this being a period of greater precipitation for the Northeast, a season that is of greater precipitation for the Northeast. And that concludes my portion of our presentation today, and with that, I'll turn it back over to John.
All right, thanks, Dan. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question if possible, And Anthony, please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly. Your name is required to introduce your question. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. It will take a few moments for the questions to come through. Please stand by. Our first question comes from Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press. Go ahead. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you for doing this. I guess I actually have two questions. I think they're mostly for Karen, although if Dan Collins wants to jump in, that would be good. Karen, first off, in terms of the drought and the 47% now, can you put that in historical context? I mean, for this time of context, for this time of year, is this normal for this time of year? Upper third, record, below normal? In other words, because it looks pretty bad, and I'm just wondering historically how bad it is, and maybe even in terms of the future context here. And then the second question, a month ago, Ira was talking about, I think it was 63% chance that that 2020 will break the record, and now it's down to 29%. I assume this is La Nina getting stronger. Can you explain why suddenly the chances of being the hottest year on record have dropped dramatically?
All right. Seth, this is Karen Gleason at NCEI, and looking at the historical time series of drought across the contiguous U.S., this certainly isn't unprecedented. Nearly half of the contiguous U.S. in drought, the last time we had that was close to the beginning of 2018, but prior to that, we saw close to 50% during, looks like spring approaching summer of 2015, and then we had more than 60% of the contiguous U.S. in drought near the end of 2012. So that is the drought of record for the drought monitor period. So it isn't unprecedented, but it certainly is covering quite a large portion of the western U.S. for sure. And then regarding your question about the temperature outlook for the globe, I think the primary driver is that October wasn't, you know, it didn't compete in at the same level as prior months. It wasn't as warm. And so it's just kind of paralleling that 2016 curve if you look back at slide number 3. So looking at the historical probabilities, which is what this temperature outlook is based on, just looking at the likelihoods and the simulations that are done to determine what the probability or the possible outcomes are based on the history, it reduced that chance of being warmest on record because October wasn't, you know, closer to a record warmest month for that month. So that's why it increased the chance of it being second and third warmest. So that's why we're stating based on the historical record and the simulations, it's very likely to be a top 3 warmest year on record.
Thank you.
Okay, operator, could we get the next question, please?
Our next question is from Brian Sullivan with Bloomberg News. Go ahead. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I have two quick questions. One is, could you talk about the long-term trends for the milder winters? You know, what's driving that, and do you have any kind of specific temperature changes that you've seen over the last few decades? And then the second question is, I came on to the call late. Actually, Seth sent me a note telling me the call was going on. When do you expect you can say the California fire season has ended this year?
I I guess this is Dan Collins. I'll speak to the decadal timescale, long-term trends, and mild winters. I can just describe for you, you didn't refer to specific areas of the U.S., but the long-term trends played a role in our forecast for the winter, and they're particularly towards warmer temperatures in the Southwest and across the Southeast, and to some extent for the Northeast U.S. as well. The pattern of above normal temperatures that you see in our seasonal outlook, that's actually, for the above normal, it's fairly similar to simply the winter trends. There are very weak trends or even slightly negative in some areas of the northern central U.S. It's an anomaly somewhat globally, but the trends are particularly strong for the Southwest and across the Southeast, as I said, and the Northeast. And so they tend to tilt our forecast towards likely above normal temperatures for those regions.
And what's the big driver in your mind?
This is long-term changes in climate.
Mm-hmm.
These are the areas that are most influenced during that season by the long-term changes in climate. We do see more broad increases in temperature for other seasons. Late summer into early fall is more broadly across the U.S. A tilt towards more likely above normal temperatures. But for these regions, we have greater probability of above normal temperatures in winter due to the long-term changes in climate.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is Dan McAvoy. I can speak to your question about the California fire season. So usually the fire season can be considered ended in parts of California when you have a substantial wetting rain. And again, this year that first rain came pretty late. And I would say for the northern third of California, about the northern third of California, this last system that just moved through yesterday brought very substantial rain and mountain snow to the northern Sierra Nevada and mountains of northwest California, and likely ended the fire season for about the northern third of California. Now, as you go further south, the dryness, the cutoff of where that storm brought moisture is pretty sharp. We're definitely still, the fire season has not ended for probably the southern two-thirds of the state. And if you look at the Predictive Services Significant Wildland Fire Potential Outlook, they still have Southern California as above normal potential for wildfire into December. And we've had large fires in December and January in Southern California. So it's certainly not over for the southern half of the state.
Our next question comes from John Schwartz with the New York Times. Go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, folks. Thanks for holding the briefing. I'm wondering, and maybe this is for Karen, you mentioned that the drought level covers much of the U.S. and, you know, that it's high but not exceptionally high or not uniquely high. What about the areas of severe drought? Is there an expansion there, and is that of interest? Thank you.
All right, so this is Karen. If I understand your question right, I think you're talking about sort of the intensity, the exceptional, extreme to exceptional, like the D3, D4 regions. Again, I'm looking at a time series that's on the Drought Monitor website that you unfortunately don't have, you know, in front of you right now unless you have quick fingers and know where to look. But the aerial extent of that D4, for instance, that exceptional, it looks like it's just under 6% of the contiguous U.S., We had periods, as far as how extensive is that, there are periods that are similar to that, looking back in time, and I'm seeing almost 5% in spring of 2014, but back in that sort of drought of record that I mentioned in the drought monitor period towards the end of or the fall of 2012, I'm seeing that exceptional drought in the 6% range, and looks like almost reaching 7%, getting close towards the changeover into 2013. So it certainly is somewhat comparable, but not quite as high as then. But it has increased and deepened in the last several weeks compared to earlier in October, where there wasn't nearly as much exceptional droughts. There has been an increase over the last, 4 weeks or so.
Thank you.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Joseph Cerna with the Los Angeles Times. Go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Some of this question's already been addressed with the fire outlook for California for the rest of this year, but I was wondering if you can maybe expand on that. And do you see any parallels between what we have lined up for these next few months and the winter of 2017 when we had the Thomas fire followed by the atmospheric river in January that caused the mudslide in Santa Barbara? With the lower precipitation expected through December, it looks like, and maybe through the winter, do you see that kind of potential there for atmospheric rivers to come after this fire season? And I guess if you can say anything more about if there's any forecast for wind events that would exacerbate fires later this year. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Dan McAvoy again. I think maybe I could expand on that a little bit. And yes, as we saw with the La Nina conditions that favors drier than normal winter condition or winter precipitation in Southern California. And so that's going to will extend the fire season if we don't get those substantial rains. And then, of course, the weather and climate in Southern California is so highly variable that we could have these very long extended dry seasons, very bad fire conditions. And then, of course, we have burn scars, and that opens the door for landslides and flooding if we do get a large atmospheric river. And even in a drier than average total precipitation for the winter, you can still have a significant atmospheric river come through Southern California. And so that's definitely going to be a danger going through the winter. I can't speak specifically to any atmospheric river forecast other than that in the near term, in the next couple of weeks, there are none expected, and it's supposed to stay dry in Southern California. And of course, then we have the Santa Ana wind season, which can certainly enhance the spread and growth of fires if any fires do start before we get significant rains in Southern California. So the setup for the winter will definitely tilt the odds to extending the fire season in the southern part of the state.
Our next question comes from Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press. Go ahead. Your line is now open.
Yes, thanks again. I guess this is for Dan Collins. Looking at this, is it fair to say the La Nina is now moderate, and what are the chances? Are we looking at this continuing into a strong La Nina? You gave us the forecast for how long it may last, but what about the strength? Because that seems, tends to matter. And then if you don't mind totally on the flyer, and of course it has to be a good Jewish boy to ask this, but we're coming up on Christmas. Are we seeing a lower percentage chance of a white Christmas for most of the United States than we would normally? I mean, in other words, looking at your forecast, what, yeah, I know it's more than a month out, but what does our white Christmas chances look like in general, broadly based? Thanks.
Sure. Okay. So as to the strength of La Nina, I'd like to refer you to the CPC website in part. I will describe it for you, but we have a new experimental product to try to give a likelihood of the different strengths of La Nina. We refer to the La Nina strength primarily through the eastern central Pacific sea surface temperature anomalies, or departures from normal, with a strong departure from normal being 1.5 degrees Celsius below normal. So there we have on our website a probability given of approximately 44% that it will develop into a strong La Nina for the December, January, February winter season. As I already noted, it is highly likely that La Nina, of course, will persist into winter, and there is some potential for it to become a strong event. And if the temperatures in the tropical Pacific become more strong departure below normal, then that'll have increased impacts, or at least the increased likelihood of the typical impacts of La Nina over the U.S. So as the impacts lead to more precipitation across the northern 48 states and less precipitation across the southern 48 states, that become ever more likely to occur if it develops into a strong La Nina. As to the winter, as to the Christmas forecast, if you will, taking a quick look at, we have experimental forecasts. Actually, they have not. We don't have really forecasts that reach this far into the future for say even Christmas week, let alone Christmas Day. So it's very difficult to say precisely. And unfortunately, looking at our outlooks as well, we don't really have much for New York in terms of precipitation forecast. We don't have much clear indication for December. It's equal chances of above or below normal. So I can't tell you much in terms of whether there's likely even to be precipitation, let alone snow.
Thank you.
There are no additional questions at this time. John Bateman, you may proceed.
All right, thanks so much. Well, first, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in this conference call. I will wrap up this call by asking you folks to mark your calendars for some upcoming releases. The release of the November 2020 U.S. climate statistics, which will also include a review of the autumn climate stats, is scheduled for December 8th. The release of the November 2020 global climate statistics is scheduled for December 14th. And the media telecon for the November U.S. and global climate report will be scheduled for 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, December 17th. And finally, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov media advisory site later today. If you have any further informational needs, please email me at jones.jones@noaa.gov. That is john.jonesbateman@noaa.gov. My contact information is also available at the top of the media advisory. And with that, I'll send it back to the operator to conclude the call.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, allow a moment of silence and stand by.